We'll begin the call with the first case of the day, U.S. versus Troy Smith. And Mr. Mohabbat?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did I say that correctly? All right. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Amir Mohabbat. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Troy Smith. There are two issues that are up on appeal. Number one, whether Mr. Smith's violation of the Wisconsin fleeing statute, statute 346.04 subsection 3, is a crime of violence. We argue it is not. Issue number two, whether the district court clearly erred in finding Mr. Smith had not accepted responsibility for his actions. We argue that it did. With respect to the first issue, the district court found that Mr. Smith's prior violation of the Wisconsin fleeing statute was a crime of violence, a career offender under U.S. Sentencing Guideline 4B1.1.
Therefore, and so you have to really deal with our most recent case to try to distinguish it in order for you to survive.
Well, yes, Your Honor. In addition, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court granted certiorari to U.S. v. Sykes from this circuit, S-Y-K-E-S. The Supreme Court number is 09-11311. We believe that case is directly on point to ours. Because Mr. Smith was not eligible for the two-point downward adjustment for his minor role in the offense, he received a very significant sentence. The Supreme Court previously in Begay had outlined a two-pronged test to determine whether or not a predicate crime is a crime of violence.
Let me ask you this. So would it be your position you think we should wait until the Supreme Court rules in Sykes before we rule in our case?
Yes, Your Honor. I was prepared to argue, expecting the court to resolve this matter sooner than last week. I believe on Thursday, the U.S. Court, Supreme Court granted certiorari. So I think it would be most prudent to wait until the Supreme Court resolves the Sykes case. The two prongs are whether or not there was a risk of physical injury similar to the one to burglary, arson, crimes using explosives, and extortion. And the second prong was whether the crime was purposeful, violent, and aggressive, like those enumerated crimes. This court, earlier this year in U.S. v. Dismuke, which I think is the case Your Honor was referencing.
It was.
All right. This court found that Mr. Dismuke had satisfied both prongs. However, there, Mr. Dismuke had readily conceded the first prong of the Begay test concerning risk of injury. Mr. Smith is making no such concession in this case, nor did he at the district court. The statute at issue in our case is similar to the one in the Minnesota case, U.S. v. Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R, that was decided in the Eighth Circuit. Neither statute requires anything more than disobedience. It does not. Neither requires reckless or dangerous driving, driving at a high speed, the use of force, or a likelihood of confrontation with authorities at the end of it. By way of hypothetical example, if Mr. Smith's offense was that he was driving 1 mile per hour, got a signal to pull over, refused, accelerated to 2 miles per hour for a single second before voluntarily pulling over, he will be just as guilty of violating the Wisconsin statute to someone who violated it the way, in fact, he did. I found no case law to suggest going from 1 to 2 miles per hour is aggressive or violent. And the point that I'm making here is that the facts don't matter. We have to look at a plain reading of the statute and how a typical case might violate it. Mr. Smith's violation was not violent or aggressive. The Begay test has not been satisfied. Mr. Smith is not a career offender. And his base offense level should have been 26. And on top of that, he should have gotten a two-point reduction pursuant to the PSR's recommendation for his minor role in the offense. I believe the Supreme Court in Sykes is going to find that this court has leaned too heavily on the purposeful element of the Begay test.
You got some inside information about how the Supreme Court functions?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I see you have some inside information on how the Supreme Court functions now?
Not with specificity, Your Honor. No, I don't. But I'm looking at the fact that they granted cert and
they granted cert in a lot of cases.
Yes, Your Honor, but the only other circuits.
Well, not as many as they should, but.
I agree.
Enough to keep themselves busy, I suppose.
I agree. As I understand it, every circuit is unified against the Eighth Circuit, and I think the Supreme Court, in my belief, is going to find that this court has leaned too heavily on the purposeful element, and the Supreme Court is going to find that purposeful disobedience is not the same thing as violence or aggression. And I also believe the Supreme Court in Sykes is going to find that in a typical case of failing to stop, that failure is neither aggressive nor violent. The government in its brief talked about waiver. Waiver is not the issue. Forfeiture is not the issue. In fact, on page 8 of the government's brief, they state very clearly how, in fact, Mr. Ricci, the district court lawyer for Mr. Smith, did not waive, and, in fact, he preserved the objection quite explicitly. The second argument that's up on appeal is whether the district court clearly erred in determining Mr. Smith had not accepted responsibility for his actions. We argue that it did. This court stated in U.S. v. Escobar Mejia that a defendant accepts responsibility only when he fesses up to his actual offense. Mr. Smith fessed up without delay. That is not in dispute. In U.S. v. Becerra, this court stated that the application notes in the sentencing guidelines are on the right track in emphasizing actions that show acceptance of responsibility over mere self-serving statements. Mr. Smith fulfilled actions that show his acceptance of responsibility. Mr. Smith debriefed with the government at least 11 times. He participated in a sting operation while he was in prison that stopped a possible homicide.
Well, he did get the 5K 1.1 reduction, a substantial one, didn't he?
He did, Your Honor, 30%.
And this robbery situation, I know the district judge didn't determine exactly what happened, but that incident occurred after he pled guilty, correct?
Right.
And he didn't report it to his supervising officer, did he?
Correct.
Isn't that alone some justification for the judge's determination?
I appreciate the question, Your Honor. No, I don't believe it is. The principal victim was a man named Joe Vishon Ward. The robbery happened in Mr. Smith's home. Mr. Smith was a victim of this. Maybe not the principal victim, but he was a victim. Mr. Ward notified law enforcement after the robbery. Mr. Smith's failure to report a crime that was already reported does not show he has not accepted responsibility.
But didn't the perpetrator, didn't he invite him back to his house after everything went down?
I don't see that anywhere in the record, Your Honor, no. The government's brief says, in fact, that my client recovered the stolen money from the robbers. That's not what happened. I don't see that in the record either. When I spoke to the district court attorney, he said, no, I don't see that either. In fact, the money originally belonged to my client. He gave it to the principal victim. It was robbed from him, and it was never recovered. So there's a little bit of confusion, I think, but that's how I would respond to Your Honor's question.
You're in the rebuttal time, you know.
I'm aware, Your Honor. Thank you. I'll be wrapping up very soon here. Mr. Smith had threats made against his family. His safety was in jeopardy. He kept debriefing. He kept cooperating. These are the kinds of deeds that I think this court spoke highly about in Becerra. The district court found that acceptance was not made. Why? Well, because of the criminal affiliations we just spoke about. What is that affiliation? The fact that somebody came into his house and robbed a friend. And I don't see how that shows he affiliates with criminals. Otherwise, Mr. Smith, who was also a victim, would be said to be an affiliate of a criminal just because he was victimized by a criminal. And I don't think that's the intent of the law.
You want to save any time?
I do, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Ms. Jacobs?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Michelle Jacobs for the United States. First of all, in the sentencing transcript at page 18, which is also the defendant's appendix, page 18, the defendant, during his allocution, did indicate that he went out and he got the money back from the robbers. He said because it had happened at his house, he and his family went out and got that money back. And so there is, I think there's some misunderstanding between the parties about that, but what the government refers to in its brief, and it is in the defendant's appendix at page 18, is the defendant's own statements during the sentencing hearing. Now, so I'll start with the acceptance of responsibility issue. Between those comments, the defendant's own acknowledgments, and his lack of reporting the robbery, the gun being under his pillow, there aren't a lot of findings that the district court specifically made. Did he put it under the pillow or did somebody else?
Or even whether or not it was his gun.
Right, exactly.
That was not found by the court.
It was not.
That's a problem, isn't it?
I don't think so. What Judge Randa said was, under any version of these facts, his conduct demonstrates a lack of acceptance of responsibility. He did not specifically rely on the defendant was in possession of a gun and therefore didn't accept responsibility. What he said was, given this overall conduct, and it is, not reporting a robbery. The robbery is described in more detail in the government sentencing memorandum in 5K 1.1 motion. It was a violent robbery. It occurred in the defendant's presence, in the defendant's home. The defendant went out to try to collect the money from the robbers, allowed those people back into his home. The gun is found in his home. His sister is essentially concocting a story about the gun being planted. And in the government submission, it indicates that there are jail calls that establish that the defendant knew that that was going on. So it was that overall conduct, I think, that Judge Randa was looking at not just there was a gun under the defendant's pillow when he denied acceptance or responsibility. And as this court has said, and there are cases cited in the briefs, you know, it's really deeds, not words, that the district court should look at. And that given the district court's sort of unique position in this case to view the defendant, to hear the defendant's explanations during the sentencing hearing, to consider all of his conduct in this analysis, I would submit that the district court certainly didn't clearly err. It may be that any one of us would look at this set of facts and perhaps decide differently or view the facts differently, but that's not the standard of review. The court is to give great deference to the district court's analysis of all this. And I think that's especially important in a case like this where the defendant went on at some length to try to explain his conduct, to try to sort of give his spin or his side of the story in all of this. So given all of that, I would submit that the district court did not clearly err in denying the defendant acceptance of responsibility. Now, I'm happy to answer any questions about the issue involving the fleeing conviction. But
before you get to that, can you comment on some of the comments Judge Randa made about drug crime and border violence and now violent neighborhoods in Milwaukee? Mm-hmm. Doesn't that some of that language go too far?
In this case, certainly not. I know that this issue has arisen before in some of the sentencings before Judge Randa in drug cases. But in this case, this was a very violent conspiracy, drug conspiracy that he had before him, of which this defendant was a part. This defendant had a very violent criminal history, a criminal background. The drug trafficking that this organization, gang-related organization, was doing was very violent. And so that, no, I don't think it does go too far. I think what he's saying is that the violence you see on the streets of Milwaukee is stemming, at least in part, from the very conduct of defendants like the defendant in this case. And so, I don't think so. And the issue obviously was not raised as a part of the challenge to the sentence. I know this court can obviously review it, but I would submit here this is not the kind of case where it's so far afield from the defendant's conduct and the overall conspiracy's criminal activities.
And so we know your position on whether or not this is a crime of violence, but what's your position on whether we should wait on Sykes?
Well, I think one of two things can happen. If Sykes certainly could impact the case here, whether this court waits or whether you affirm, given this court's case law, if the defendant files a petition for cert, certainly that cert petition, if the Supreme Court decides Sykes to the benefit of the defendant, in other words, finding that fleeing is not a crime of violence, the case would certainly be vacated and remanded. So I think in any event, he'll get the benefit of Sykes.
Somebody will.
I was going to say if it's decided in the defendant's favor. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs.
Thank you.
Mr. Mohabbat, how much time does he have?
1.5 minutes.
Let me take half a minute. Your opponents pointed out on page 18 of your brief you filed in the supplements is, by the, me and my family got the money that was took because it happened there, and we got it back.
Yes, Your Honor. I took a look at that after counsel spoke. My understanding is that did not happened.
Well, he said it happened. Mm-hmm.
I see that, Your Honor, but Mr. Smith did not get the money back. Maybe his family.
Wait a minute.
Yes, sir.
You said there's nothing in the record to show it.
I was mistaken.
Nothing in the record to show it except he said he got the money back.
I was mistaken, Your Honor, when I said that. Mr. Smith has informed me that he did not get the money back, and that's the point that I was trying to make. With regard to this...
You said he told you he didn't get the money back. He told the judge he did.
I see where that is in the record, Your Honor. When he said me and my family, he meant as a collective Smith family unit. I believe that's what he meant.
We got it back.
Apparently, he said the family got it back, correct?
His family got
correct.
It back.
Correct. Correct.
And he never amended his statement, or that was never clarified.
Okay. The same family unit that submitted that affidavit from his sister?
I believe so, Your Honor. With regard to the same acceptance responsibility issue, the government took no adverse position on this issue at sentencing. They have great, in my opinion, they have great esteem for him, if that's why they made this 30% 5K motion. I still believe the district court did clearly err. It awarded him a 30% reduction. Judge Randa discusses how President Obama had to go to Mexico to meet with the Mexican president about drug violence. I think, Judge Williams, you are correct. That language goes too far. And what happens on the streets of Milwaukee, Mr. Smith is just one man. He doesn't control what happens in the greater Milwaukee area. So I think if Mr. Smith was properly sentenced, his base offense points would have been a grand total of 21. 26 for the base violation, minus 2 points. May I conclude my last thought?
You're in your red zone. Finish your last thought.
Minus 2 points for minor role, minus 2 points for acceptance, minus 1 point for my government recommendation makes 21 points.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mohabbat. And thank you for keeping to your word. Sometimes counsel say their last thought and then they're going on and on. We appreciate that. We also appreciate the fact that you are appointed, right?
I am.
And you've done a fine job in representing your client and in the briefing, and we always can rely on you, Ms. Jacobs, for fine performance. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We'll call the next.